Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
Special thanks to you, Ilan, for joining us. It's really a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you in Israel as well as seeing you on screen. Ilan Troen was born in Boston, made Aliyah to Israel in 1975, and raised his family there, taught for many years at Ben-Gurion University in Be'er Sheva, although also did lots at Brandeis University. He's had a special connection to Bloomington, Indiana over a number of years. At my invitation, Ilan joined us for a semester as a visiting professor in the Bourne's Jewish Studies program. I think back on those days with great fondness, Ilan. And for a number of years has also edited books on Israel for Indiana University Press. His own forthcoming book will deal centrally and importantly with the subject of today's lecture, namely the religious dimensions of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, beyond that the Israeli-Arab dispute. In some ways, especially since October 7th, it's become a Muslim-Jewish dispute. So this is a very complex, very significant dimension of the trouble that we're all too aware of, most especially since October the 7th. Ilan and I have been in touch about his work. I had the privilege of reading his book in manuscript. It's outstanding. He wrote that book before October 7th, and we've been back and forth a little bit about his thinking since then. He'll say a word or two about that himself. Now it's my pleasure, Ilan, to turn over to you. We look forward to your talk.
Thank you, Alvin. Thank you, Gunther. It's nice to be back in Bloomington, even if only virtually. And thanks for the invitation. Yeah, October 7th is a day that's marked deeply within our family's consciousness and history. On the morning of October 7th, our daughter and son-in-law were killed in a kibbutz called Cholit on the Gaza envelope. And the event was so searing that the manuscript, which was then just about finished, I took back so that I could write a new preface. And that preface had to deal with the anomaly, the outrage of how secular people committed to allegedly universal values could support a fundamentalist theological movement that engaged in bestial activities. That's part of what I'm going to discuss as a tangle between the secular and the religious. This talk is not only about religion, it's actually about how secularity and religion are intertwined. And part of what I hope to do is to try to help you understand the relationship between the two, and the fact that it may be very often impossible to separate the two. And secondly, I redid the final part of the book because our son-in-law was a key figure in the demonstrations in this part of Israel as a musician. The speaker spoke, but my son-in-law Shlomi always had a musical interlude in which he would take usually a popular song, change the words, and adapt it to the kind of criticism that the crowd wanted to hear about the outrages of our government. Well, I'm not going to do a demonstration now of his singing or to give you an example of it, But that also informed me that to write a book at this time in Israel also means that you have to deal with the fact that it's not only our opponents, those that would do us in, that c come from religious motivations, but that religious motivations and even in some cases a religious frenzy has overtaken what has long been the secular thrust mainstream logic of the Zionist movement and of the State of Israel. And that too is a kind of tangle that needs to be unwound, and I'll try to deal with that as well. The book really begins with a cataclysmic event. The issue, the struggle between Jews and not Palestinians, but Jews and Muslims and Jews and Christians is old. For 1400 years, Muslims actually ruled this part of the world. They ruled this country. And at the Balfour, with the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, a totally unexpected, unwelcome event occurred. A Christian power took the country and gave it to the Jews. Now, that is a revolution. That is an earthquake. Because for centuries, about 17 centuries for Christianity and 14 centuries for Judaism, the issue of to whom this land belongs had been settled theologically. There were different positions, but nothing could be done about it. First, the Christians ruled it, then the Muslims ruled it, the Turks for 400 years before they were overthrown. Now, that meant that the debate could resume, but it had to resume in the 20th century and the 21st century when the discourse is no longer theological. So, what happens when debates that for centuries, since time immemorial, that have been cast in theological terms, now move to places like the League of Nations, the United Nations, the Academy, the public square, where one no longer discusses terms in the terms of theology, but one tries to persuade in secular terms. So that is a challenge for holders to beliefs long held, long established, because in all three traditions, whether or not the land was held by Jews, Christians, or Muslims, there was the expectation that in the time to come, the land would again return to any one of those three groups. And that expectation has not been disturbed by the creation of the State of Israel, even after 75 years. So the issues of legitimacy, of the validity of the Zionist experience, is still an open question, at least in theological terms, because they persist, but they are expressed in secular terms. That, in brief, is the kind of issue that I wish to address. So then, claims to Israel-Palestine are made in both secular and theological terms, and they can, and I would argue, if we want to really understand them, they should be disentangled and separated. And what I would like to do is to try to show the kinds of relationships between the two. Well, let me begin with the oldest kind of claims, and they are obviously religious ones. In this part of the world, this country is not just territory, it's a holy land for three different groups. And the Holy Land, and has the notion of Holy Land was wonderfully expressed by Rashi about 1,000 years ago in his first commentary on the opening words of the book of Genesis. And the argument is that the world belongs to the Lord. And the Lord, it is the Lord, he or she. It is the Lord who assigns it to whomever the Lord wants. And Rashi, of course, thought that he gave the land to the Jews. Other versions of the Lord have other assignees. That notion of the Lord as an active participant in human affairs lasts certainly into the Enlightenment. We still say, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, Deo Volenti, Inshallah. The notion that somehow God chooses rulers, let alone assigns territory, or a particular territory is not an idea that has gone out of fashion. Even in the United States, which has an important role to play in the secularization of assigning land, this country, or your country, I'm now in Israel, began with the notion that God was very much involved in the Mayflower Compact. And it takes about 200 years for ways in which Americans imagined their legitimate rights to North America to become expressed in secular language. Won't go through the whole of it, but you certainly know of John Locke, labor theory of property, who follows on Hugo Grotius. Now, these people were not anti-religious. They really had a different way of accessing knowledge. And through that, they thought they could develop theories of natural rights and natural law. Jefferson is a great proponent of that. But the key individual whose law cases are still cited all over the world is John Marshall, the head of the Supreme Court, who in a variety of cases, three to be exact, in the end of the 1820s, early 1930s, actually proposes a secular system of how land ought to be claimed. And they include conquest. That's the easy one, which, by the way, in terms of international law, until the rise of the United Nations during and after the Second World War, was still considered legitimate. For those of you who know the intricacies of history, is that America should have had a mandate, Armenia, at the end of the First World War, and the basis was its participation on the winning side in the First World War. Out of conquest comes treaties, of course. That uses international law explicitly to create claims and to affirm claims. And then there are other ways in which land is claimed. Discovery. We still the bottom of the ocean. I suppose the Arctic is still under contention. Space is the next frontier. But in case of the Holy Land, everybody knew or thought they knew about the Holy Land, but the Holy Land is actually rediscovered in the 19th and 20th century because it's rediscovered for a different purpose, and that's to integrate it into the international economic system. And the question was, how many people could live there? Labor, that's John Locke, I won't pursue that. You could buy land. And what's interesting about all these cases is that you could find lawyers that would argue both the Arab side and the Jewish side and make very good, credible arguments. So something else is at work in the way in which logic and arguments are formulated, and that something else is culture, cultural prejudices, cultural beliefs, and very often religion. That's particularly the case in the use of history. History is post-Marshall. History really becomes an important way in which people use secular arguments to claim land by the end of the 19th century, certainly the 20th century. And I've written down a couple of categories. One is indigeneity, which had a different meaning a century ago than it does today, and colonialism. As something that's wrong, has increasingly been abused. And finally, the notion of self-determination of peoples, and the great issue would become who constitutes a people. And as you know, that the great contribution of the Balfour Declaration was that it claimed that Jews were a people in a modern sense, not merely in a theological sense. And that's why 1917 and Balfour is still such a contentious issue. Are Jews a people? Are Palestinians a people? Are Arabs a people? And if they are a people, how are they to be defined? Is it one Ummah, one nation, or are there subsets of it? These are arguments are very much alive, but the notion of peoplehood is also a notion that's not very far from a whole host of religious ideas and theological concepts. Let me give you an example of how these ideas formulated in international law that's supposed to be objective, and it was expected that somehow it would be neutral and therefore abet or alleviate conflict, in fact, doesn't do so. One of the arguments has to do with discovery and the economic absorptive capacity of Palestine. It may have been the single most contentious issue about which there's the largest literature after the First World War. And there were those who argued, well, the Balfour Declaration may have given the land to Jews, but only if it didn't prejudice the rights and privileges of the population who was there. Well, the reality is that at the time roughly of the Balfour Declaration, there were only 700,000 people from, and I'll invent a phrase, from the river to the sea. Today, there are 14 million or 20 times that amount. 14 million or 20 times that amount. So that in effect, in a scientific objective fact, there was plenty of room in Palestine. Nevertheless, the British decided otherwise. And the reason why they did so, despite massive scientific evidence, was political. And so although international law could have resided on science, it was ultimately political, and the politics had to do with the identity of the contending groups. Supporters of the Arab viewpoint imagined the Holy Land in very romantic terms. They imagined a land of peasants, of shepherds, traditional farming. Supporters of the Zionist view looked to history, and they found that there were 3 million people at the time of the Roman Byzantine period. In short, there were far more people in the Holy Land in the past than at present. People like the great archaeologist William Foxwell Albright and Walter Loudermilk, probably not known to you, but a very important person who was involved with the TVA and soil conservation from China to deserts all over the world. Now, what's characteristic about both Albright and Loudermilk is that they were believing Protestants, and that it fit their theology that Jews would come back and that they would reclaim the land, restore the land, rebuild the land. And it would, in short, from their theological preference to their scientific work, there was a very, very short leap. And that would be typical. Indigeneity, the emergence of history, is a key argument. Well, initially, indigeneity is used actually in the 1920s and 1930s, but it refers to a numerical majority. It doesn't have any of the kind of legal weight that it does at present. In 2007, if I'm not mistaken, the United Nations has a declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, but that's not the way it's used initially. What occurred, and this is an interesting case of an idea that's captured and transformed for different purposes, in this case, for, as I'm going to explain later, for theological reasons. In the 1960s, Central America, leftists, priests, generally Roman Catholics, wanted to object to United Fruit, capitalism, particularly American capitalism, and they began arguing for the rights of indigenous people. That's a movement that spreads to Australia, to the First Peoples of Canada. And by the first decade of the 21st century, that should be 2207, not 2007, it's this century, it's only less than 20 years ago, there's the United States Declaration on Indigeneity, and it lays out the rights of Native peoples to maintain their own language, to maintain their economy, to protect them from the rapaciousness of international capitalism and imperialism. In short, indigeneity gets caught up in the language of imperialism and colonialism. And that becomes, therefore, a highly charged topic, and one that is only selectively applied. It reaches Palestine, Israel, in the 1990s through the agency of some Bedouin intellectuals who claim that they are indigenous. And whereas until then, the notion of indigeneity was applied only to the pre-Columbian world. To apply indigeneity to Europe or to Africa or to Asia is to open up a can of worms like the one those of us who live in Israel have to endure. Middle Eastern claims. Indigeneity also leads to historical analyses of who has rights to land. In the immediate aftermath of the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire, a whole group of people claimed special characteristics, peoplehood, based upon the ancient past. The Lebanese Maronites claimed somehow a connection to the Phoenicians. The Copts claimed that they transcended, that they were pre-Islamic connections with the Pharaonic Egyptians. If you would go into the National Museum in Ankara, you would find that the first main rooms are devoted to a study of the Hittites. Even in Palestine, Ratosh was the key person, but there were Jewish Canaanites who were overwhelmed by the discoveries of Ugaritic and imagined Semitic languages as somehow being Hebrew at base. But the whole notion of making claims based upon ancient lineage got a big boost when Nasser lost the 1967 war and he died, because Pan-Arabism, as the dominant ideology of this region, ended with him. And what you have are some fascinating events, like the Hashemites claiming that they are related to the Nabataeans. If you would take a look at some Hashemite Jordan currency, you will find a picture of the king of Jordan. On with one hand is the Holy Mount in Jerusalem, and the other hand is Petra. In short, the traditional role of the Hashemite family was to be the protector of holy places, Mecca, Medina, and now Jerusalem and Petra. The Palestinians claim that they predate the Hebrews, and the Hebrews were only a passing event at best in the history of this region, and the land is fundamentally Arab, and when they say Arab, they mean Palestinian. Hence, Jesus, who well before the Romans to call this Syria Palestina, they consider Jesus to be a Palestinian, an idea that has yet to be born. We'll deal with Christian liberation theology a little bit later on. What I'm trying to suggest is that notions like history that ought to be somehow neutral in one way or another rely upon sources whose other use and traditional use has been sacred, and they are then reused, retempered for use for contemporary polemics. Well, I think I already dealt with that. Instances of correlation. Now, I think I already dealt with that too. Oh my goodness. Secular basis. I think this, I know I'm going the wrong way. I should go forward. There we go. Here's an example of Palestinian liberation theology. So I'm coming to it, Alvin, coming to theology at last. The fundamental document was written by Naeem Atik, a Protestant theologian who argues from 1 Peter 2:5 that Palestinian Christian Arabs are living stones, referring to the notion that they are the direct descendants of those who inhabited Palestine and accepted Jesus. They are, to use the word, the foundation stones for a Christian renewal in the Holy Land. The only evidence he brings for this, it isn't like he has family lists. The only evidence he brings is that Atik in Arabic, he could have also said Hebrew, means ancient. This is a force of imagination over scientific proof. And he becomes the author of a very important book, the study guide, Zionism Unsettled, which is a blend of historical studies by people who are notable anti-Zionists, some of them are Jews, and many are not, and biblical scholars who try to create a secular history of this country and cast Jews as Europeans who are latter-day interlopers in a region which is not theirs. In short, they're not indigenous, they're not native. What this really is for me is a form of secular supersessionism. That's part of the tangle. When you say, as supersessionists would say, is that the most among the famous historians is Toynbee, Jews are fossils, what you're really saying is that they've ended their role in history. In effect, what the liberation theologians are saying is that the ancient Jews ended their role in history. There's a new people in Europe, maybe from the Khazars or from whatever other sources, who have then been sent back here by European empires to take our land from us. So therefore, this is a case of classic colonialism. This is found particularly in a colleague of Atik Mitri Rahib, a Lutheran from Bethlehem, who in fact uses the word which serves my purposes very well, and that he talks about theopolitics, is that politics can be both secular and they can also be theological. And the notion of suspending or using supersessionism in a secular guise is validated and promoted by people not only like Atik, but also Mitri Rahib, and a vast array of publications that are spread through the web and in published form. So colonial settler, a supersessionist, and terminating the role of ancient Hebrews in history and viewing them as ancient, as intruders. You know, what's interesting is that the temptation to blend the religious with the secular is also, of course, found in Zionism. The Zionist claim found in the Declaration of Independence is allegedly a secular document. For example, I outlined here, they wrote and gave the Bible to the world. That's a very problematic statement. In 1986, when I was director of the Ben-Gurion Research Institute, and we were celebrating or trying to celebrate the centenary of Ben-Gurion's birth, we thought we would have the people of Israel sign on the Declaration of Independence. After a week, we gave up the enterprise because we discovered that religious Zionists wouldn't sign. They signed the declaration, but in 1986, they wouldn't sign again. Why? Because the declaration claims that the Bible was not given at Mount Sinai. The conditions in 1947-48 were different than they were in 1986, and they felt that they could reject. The part that I find most interesting is that I had always thought that the end of it, the Rock of Israel, Tzur Yisrael, was a way in which the framers of Israel's Declaration of Independence could elide the issue of the country's legitimacy by not saying that it was, you know, God had given the land to us, as quoting Rashi and the rabbis. But then I discovered that there's a debate about that. If you would open up the Jewish Telegraphic Agency's version of a translation of Israel's Declaration of Independence, it translates Tzur Yisrael, the Rock of Israel, as Almighty God. That leads to what I mentioned about my son-in-law and the struggle going on in Israel today between those who would argue that our claims to land are based upon a religious directive, and that we cannot give up the biblical heartland of this country because it belongs to us, because this country is Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, it is the beginning of the mighty redemption, has always been an undercurrent. But that's a basic point that I need to spend one more minute on. People live at many different levels. The person who was perhaps most influential in making me think about this issue was Peter Berger. Peter Berger had me as a member of his seminar at Boston University, together with a whole host of people from all over the world. And our task was to validate, if possible, the notion that modernity leads inexorably to secularism. and from China to Latin America to the Soviet Union, even across Europe and certainly the United States, the conclusion was it doesn't. People, religion is alive and well. It is an undercurrent that can be very powerful and can even overtake secular revolutions. And one can test that in places like India with Modi overcoming Nehru's India, or Erdogan supplanting the kind of Turkey that Kemal Atatürk imagined. Well, I'm going to skip over this next section and begin to get into theological claims. Otherwise, I'm not going to have enough time. My point is, all Abrahamic monotheisms have multiple strands. There is no such thing as a Jewish view, an Islamic view, or a Christian view. There are multiple strands, even as there are multiple secular ideas. Hence, I like the idea of tangles. You have to imagine a warp and a woof, and that individuals choose between the threads that are secular and the threads that are religious, and out of that they weave the fabric of the idea that motivates them and enables them to interpret the issue of Israel or the Holy Land. Judaism, I'm not going to spend time on it. What most people, almost all people, agree upon is the place. The Holy Land is where I happen to be sitting, just outside the city of Beersheba. But they can argue about the boundaries, but most importantly, they will argue about when the land may be taken. Do we wait for the Messiah or don't we? And we can argue about who has agency and how that land is to be taken. By force, by ethical means, those are the great debates. Haredis will wait for the Messiah, non-intervention. Religious Zionism is actually split. The brief anecdote is Avi Ravitsky arguing with Hanan Porat. Avi Ravitsky was a head of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University. Hanan Porat was the founder of Gush Emunim. Hanan Porat got up at Van Leer and said that he believes that and that Israel will become a country of halakha and that the Messiah is going to come. Ravitsky got up and said, I agree with you that this is going to be a state ruled by halakha and that the Messiah will come. But the difference between us is you know when and you know by whom. I don't. Hence, Hanan Porat became a settler who would break the laws of Israel, and Ravitsky could become a leader of Meimad. In short, religious Zionism, it can have different streams. It tends to less today. Reform, you know that it went through tradition. It was anti-Zionist at the end of the 19th century. During the anti-Semitic period of the 1930s, it favored a Jewish state. Brit Shalom really is connected with the issue of how, that the land has to be taken in an ethical manner and not by any other means. And so that they become proponents of a binational state. My point here is that there is no one Jewish view. There are many Jewish views, and as there are with certainly in Christianity. The key issue for Christians is, does God still speak to the Jews? Is St. Augustine right? Is supersessionism right? Is replacement theology, does that still have force? Did the coming of Jesus abrogate those covenants, or do they remain in force? Do the Jews still have a role in history? And if so, what is it? Do they still have a connection to the promised land? And what may it be? The answers either confirm or deny the validity of the prophetic vision of the ingathering of the exiles to the promised land and to the establishment of a Jewish state. There are multiple streams that produce diverse political choices. Roman Catholicism, which is probably the largest group within Christianity, began the 20th century with a totally negative view. And I gave here, you can see on your screen, the quote that comes from a famous conversation between Pope Pius X and Herzl in 1904, where Herzl totally denies it's totally supersessionist. The Jews have not recognized our Lord. We therefore cannot recognize the Jewish people. And he promised to send armies of missionaries to convert the Jews should Herzl ever send lots of Jews there. But on the other hand, 100 years later, we have Pope Francis at Yad Vashem and recognition between Catholicism and the state of Israel, not yet as a Jewish state, but the state of Israel. In between, there's a lot of travail. Even after the state is created, Pope Paul VI, an 11th hour visit in 1964, never utters the word Israel. He thanks the authorities. It took John Paul II in his 5-day visit after Nostra Aetate in 1965, and diplomatic relations were established after Oslo, for him to really come to embrace the leaders of Israel as the leaders of Israel. That revolution, which I'm going to, is really inherent in what John Polakowski, who I understand has spoken for this forum in the past, has in mind when he urges multiple valid covenants. It is a movement within Christianity that says there doesn't have to be one covenant for the Jews and one cup. There can be multiple covenants. God need not be restricted, and that God's covenant with the Jews may still be valid. That has an enormous impact, in many cases still underground, because it's still hard to translate that into official church policy. I wrote here in red letters, the Roman Catholic Church over United Nations General Assembly Resolution 181, they were among the most important forces against Zionism until October 1947. Why? Because the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches made great headway in the 19th century with something called the capitulations, that is, wresting power away from the Ottomans as the Ottoman Empire began its long demise. And they were learning how to deal with the with Islam in a of a weakened state. And then when the British, a fellow Christian state, took over the Holy Land with the mandate, they thought they could manipulate the British. And then when they saw the choice was going to have to be the Jews or the Arabs, they had a far more experience in dealing with the Arabs, and they were adamantly opposed to partition until the Soviet Union and the United States got together and said there's going to be partition. And over 3 weeks beforehand, they agree only to create this, you know, Palestina duitas this and tres partes, this tripartite division, which gave not only a Jewish state and a Christian and a Arab state, but also an international condominium over Jerusalem. When that doesn't work out, there are any number of Catholic states that say, announce publicly that we regret our vote for 181. Why is that important? Because 181 partition passed by one vote. Total rejection by the Muslim world. If it were not for the Christian world, there would have been no Jewish state. This is one of my favorite parts, evangelicalism. Evangelicalism is really a suspended supersessionism. If you want proof of it, turn on your YouTube and see the way in which the American embassy was dedicated when it moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The major speakers are two evangelicals, Jeffress from Texas and John Hagee from Texas. In fact, the largest and most generous philanthropic organization for the state of Israel happens to be an evangelical one, CUFI, Christians United for Israel. They have 10 million members. They give an important, a large fortune of money. And it's because this is part of God's plan. It's the end time, and they will support Israel on that basis. Far more interesting is mainline Protestantism, and here's a fascinating case of how again English Protestants affect American Protestants. The key player here is John Parks, James Parks, an Anglican who writes a book in the 1920s. He's a graduate of Oxford. He spends time in Europe, is offended by the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany and beyond. And he begins talking by around 1930 of a double covenant, predating what John Polakowski will be doing some decades later, and suggesting there need not be just one covenant for Jews and another for, there can be covenants for Jews and for Christians. And he comes out with the saying, "I see Judaism and Christians as sympathetic." The most interesting and important figure in mid-20th century, certainly America and maybe on the world stage, is this person that we don't talk about much anymore, and that's Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr appeared on the cover of Time magazine a few months after the vote for partition.